Ennis had lost his helmet, backpedaling like mad, basically trying not to die. Also having learned from fighting with his brothers growing up, Gareth attacked from behind, slamming the board down on the Fury's back with all the force he could muster. The blow never connected, the Fury dodging to the side at the last moment. "She has eyes in the back of her head," Gareth thought. When this was over, assuming they won, he would be sorely tempted to cut away her red hair to check for a second set of eyes. Pincered between them, the Fury trained one eye on each foe. Gareth's eyes met Ennis's, and a plan passed between them. Gareth hoped they were thinking the same thing. He threw his pillow. The Fury's eyes widened in surprise, as did Ennis's. Apparently they hadn't had the same plan after all. As Gareth shoved the jagged end of the board at the warrior woman's face. She caught it with one hand, splinters stabbing into her palm, drawing blood. The pillow, on the other hand, landed harmlessly on the floor. It was a nice distraction, but did little actual damage, unless, of course, the Fury had a severe allergy to goose feathers. Gareth, now weaponless, waited to have his head removed from his shoulders, wondering whether it would hurt less or more than being rejected by his brother at the Bridge of Triumph. The strike never came. Instead, the Fury's eyes widened further, her mouth gaped open, and something shimmered from her stomach, protruding between two ribs. The tip of a blade. Her mouth, now dribbling blood, transformed into a snarl.
"May you rot in the first heaven," she said.
Ennis wrenched his sword back through the way it had entered, and the Fury died, landing face down and likely ruining a rather expensive-looking Crimean rug with her blood. All week, Gareth had been considering relieving himself on the same rug, but it seemed she had taken care of it for him, a fact that held a certain irony. Ennis looked at Gareth, his light-coloured beard speckled with drying blood. He said,
"I don't make promises lightly."
"I can see that," Gareth said. Another board cracked, and they both pivoted to face the figure stepping through the now open window.
"Gwen," Gareth said, "thanks for the help, but we've got it covered."
Her armour shone in the starlight, her eyes as bright as twin yellow moons. Over her shoulders hung thick coils of rope. She eyed the two men before her eyes flitted to the two dead bodies littering the floor. She almost looked surprised, something that sent a flash of annoyance through Gareth.
"We don't always need your help," he thought.
"Usually, but not always." Her gaze seemed to settle on the random pillow lying beside the Fury, soaking up her pooling blood. Gareth explained,
"I guess they don't teach pillow fighting in the Furium."
A surprised cough chuckle exploded from Ennis.
"You are full of tricks, Prince of the East."
"You don't know the half of it," Gwen said. "You should have seen the stunt he pulled in Restor on the way here."
"My friends love to ruin a good time," Gareth said, though he felt his cheeks burning.
The Restor incident had not been one of his finer moments.
"You don't have long,"
Ennis said, snapping them all back to reality.
"I left one guard unconscious but alive, and other patrols might pass the base of the tower and see the bodies."
Gwen slung the rope to the floor.
"Right. Secure it to something immovable. I'll feed it down the side."
While Ennis located one end and hustled out the door, presumably to tie it to one of the tower's permanent fixtures, Gareth said,
"We're going through the window."
Gwen didn't look at him.
"From what I heard, you already tried it once, only without the rope."
Her tone was cold. Hard. Angry.
"I had no choice," Gareth said. "Rhea Loren was going to use me against my brother, ransom me for Bjorn Stonesledge. I failed my people once. I won't fail them again."
Gwen didn't look up.
"One, there is always a choice, and two, you're only failing yourself with this attitude."
He was surprised at the sincerity he heard in her words. She stood and hauled the rope to the window, easing it over the side, releasing it in segments, presumably so it wouldn't draw attention from the ground as it unfurled.
"You sound like Roan," Gareth said, feeling a bulge of warmth in his chest.
"He's a wise man when he's not being a fool," Gwen said, finally turning to look at him.
"And I believe I owe you a thank you."
"For what?"
Ennis told me what you said when he offered you a chance at escape. He came for me first, just like you asked. He busted you out of the dungeons.
Ennis returned then.
She almost broke my neck in the process, he said.
Truthfully, she had the situation well in hand. But, yes, I tried to help.
Thank you, Gareth said.
I don't know what else to say.
Strange, he thought, the way friends could be made in the unlikeliest of places.
There's something you need to know, Ennis said. He was looking at Gwen.
There's no time. You can tell us Darkspell is creating a potion for Rhea that will kill only Orions, he blurted out.
What?
Gareth and Gwen said at the same time.
It's true, Ennis said.
She was planning to experiment with it on you, but now she's going to release this plague directly into the waters of the Spear.
Gareth said,
but half of the eastern water supply is connected to that river.
If the potion spread,
thousands will die,
Gwen said, her voice barely above a whisper.
Ennis nodded.
Which is why you need to stop it.
Gareth nodded.
This man was a true ally.
Thank you, he said,
for everything.
Enough talk, Gwen said.
There will be time for cuddling and planning later, once the city is well behind us.
As if to add emphasis to her statement, shouts echoed from the stairwell, followed by the thunder of dozens of boots on stone. A temple bell, which doubled as a castle alarm system, pealed in response, cracking open the silent night. The guards at the base of the tower had been discovered.
Now, Gwen said,
sprinting for the window and flinging herself over the sill. She hung from the edge, leaving enough room for Gareth and Ennis to descend first. Gareth positioned himself on the sill, grasping the rope with both hands. He turned to face the wall, planting both feet firmly on the stone.
Use these, Gwen said,
handing him a pair of thick leather gloves. He quickly slipped them on, one at a time, and then began to slide down the rope, clamping it between his feet and squeezing with the leather gloves to slow his speed.
Above him, Gwen said,
You next.
The volume of her voice fading away.
Before Gareth dropped out of range, he heard Ennis say,
I'll be right behind you. I need to make certain none of the guards hack through the rope.
Gareth could hear the lie in the man's voice. Ennis Loren was staying to protect them to the end. And, Gareth knew, it would finally, at long last, cost the man his life.
20. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Ennis Loren.
This was his penance, Ennis knew it. It wasn't that he thought he'd been dishonorable. No, it was far worse. At least a dishonorable act was an act. Instead, he'd done nothing, while his cousin had made rash decisions and destroyed so much of herself, even as she was destroying everything he loved about the West. Yes, he'd argued with her and provided opposing counsel, but those were just words. Action felt so much better, even if his every breath was treason. They came in waves, rushing up the winding staircase with blood in their eyes. Ennis's only advantages were maintaining the high ground, and the fact that the stairs were so narrow only two men could attack at once. He used these advantages for a time, slashing throats and kicking the corpses down the steps, where they crashed into the reinforcements just behind them. He fought not for Gwendolyn or Gareth, not for Rhea or the West, not even for his own life. No, he fought for something more difficult to describe. It was a muddled hope and a hazy future, and the fuzzy image of children running through the streets, laughing and playing and knowing nothing of war or violence. He fought for those unnamed children, even as blood streamed down his arms, both his and his enemies. He fought for those future children as, eventually, several guards broke through, forcing him back. He tripped over the rope that was still taut with the weight of Gwendolyn Storm and Gareth Ironclad, creaking slightly as they slid down it. One of the guards spotted the cord, realization dawning in his eyes, and he swung his sword. Ennis lunged, extending his weapon to the end of his reach, barely managing to deflect the guard's blade. Rather than slicing through the rope, it slashed across the top of it, severing a half dozen threads in the process.
The rope twisted, feeling the pressure of losing a portion of its strength, shuddering slightly as the weight on its end jerked violently. And then the guard was swinging again, and Ennis was finding his balance and blocking the blow, even as another guard sprang forward and aimed his own blade for the rope. Clang, clang, clang. Ennis deflected three separate attempts from three separate guards, spinning and pivoting, a maelstrom of last-ditch effort. One finally got through, and that was all it took. The rope snapped, one end dropping harmlessly to the floor while the other whipped away through the window and out of sight. Ennis, a prayer for his unexpected friends on his lips, dropped his sword, sank to his knees, and said, "I surrender." Gwendolyn Storm. Although what Ennis had told them about Darkspell's potion was still ringing through Gwen's mind, she pushed it away. There would be time to process it all later. Now she had to focus, because something was wrong. As they dangled, still halfway up the side of the tower, the ground a distant nothing below, the rope shuddered and then began twisting. And she knew. She knew. Ennis had saved their lives by staying behind. But that didn't mean they were safe, not even close. "Go!" she screamed at Gareth, who, in his obvious humanness, seemed to move down the rope at a trickle while she was ready to be a cascading waterfall. Gareth looked up, the fear clear in his eyes. This wasn't the time for it, and yet Gwendolyn felt a shred of relief pass through her when she saw it. Because if he was scared of falling to his death, that meant he didn't want to die any more. She could use that. "I'll show you," she said quickly, clambering past him. She hooked her feet around the rope for balance, and then let the thick threads slide through, slowly at first and then faster and faster, her hero mark flaring on her cheek, providing a supernatural level of strength, speed, and agility. She glanced up and was buoyed to see Gareth following in her wake, barreling slightly out of control, his mouth open in a silent scream. When she looked back down, the ground grew larger and larger, like a giant black mouth yawning open. Closer. Closer. With a jerk, the rope snapped, launching her downwards at double the speed. Her body, stretched tight as a bowstring, reacted instantly, changing position in the air so that she was horizontal rather than vertical, her feet churning beneath her as she sprinted down the wall. When she neared the bottom, she leapt, throwing herself forward into a somersault, tumbling across the soft grass of the gardens, coming out of the roll in a crouch. "Holy Orion," she thought, impressing even herself. Even after 9 decades of learning about the abilities bestowed upon her by her fate mark, she could still be surprised by what she could do. That thought, however, flashed past in less than a second, as she was already pushing off, charging back for the base of the tower, craning her head skyward, following the sound of Gareth's scream to its source, a deadweight body plummeting for the ground like a bird clipped of its wings. She caught him in both arms, swinging downwards in an arc to prevent breaking his spine upon impact. Still, the force of his momentum, coupled with her swinging catch, sent them both sprawling end over end, a tangle of arms and legs. When they came to a halt, Gareth said, "Whoa!" as he released his breath. And then the archers arrived on the garden walls.
Gareth Ironclad.
"Why can't anything ever be easy?" Gareth thought as the first arrow whizzed past, embedding itself in a tree. He'd almost died from the fright of the fall, and now he was about to be turned into a human pincushion. It wasn't his best day, and the sun hadn't even breached the horizon. Of course, the damn Orion wasn't about to let either of them stop to catch their breaths. She was up in an instant, grabbing his arm and hauling him to his feet, yanking him into a forced run. He supposed he should be thankful to have such a capable warrior helping him, but right now he just felt doomed, which was slightly better than the boredom of being locked in the tower for days on end. "Faster!" Gwen hissed, although Gareth was fairly certain he was already moving at maximum speed, arrows zipping past much too close for comfort. And then she slammed to a stop and said another word he didn't want to hear, "Up!" It wasn't a command so much as a preview of what was coming next, because she picked him up with arms much stronger than they looked and threw him into the air, a place he really wasn't keen to revisit after his last experience. "Grab," she said next, and Gareth did, wrapping his arms around a thick branch well off the ground. A moment later, Gwen was beside him, although he wasn't certain how, whether she'd jumped or simply run up the tree. She grabbed him and threw him again, almost as if it had all become a game, and he was naught but an object to be tossed about. At least this time he was ready for it, was already looking up to catch the next branch, which was nearly halfway to the top of the tree. This continued twice more, until the thin uppermost branches bent precariously under his weight as he caught them. "Hell no," he said, when he realized what the only possible next move was. The top of the wall was an insane distance away, perhaps thrice his own height, and 6 or 7 archers were already racing along the wall toward the closest spot, fitting bows to strings, preparing to stop, turn, and— Gwen picked him up and stuffed him under her arm like a child, ran down the edge of the narrow branch like it was as broad as a road, and the branch, bowing under their combined weight, leapt. The archers were so surprised by the move that they froze, only able to watch as the pair flew through the air, Gwen landing softly on both feet. "Ready?" she asked, as she set Gareth back on his feet. Gareth thought she might be speaking a foreign language, but he nodded anyway, waiting to be jerked, yanked, or thrown into whatever the next step was in her plan. To his surprise, however, she did none of those things, taking off along the wall at a sprint, right toward where 3 of the archers were kneeling, retracting their arrows. She rolled, and Gareth ducked, and the darts flew past, stopping only when they slammed into the chests of the other 3 archers, who, screaming, toppled from the wall. Ahead of him, Gwen came up in a full sprint, crashing into 2 of the archers, flinging them to the sides where there was nothing but empty air. The 3rd archer tried to run, but Gwen launched herself up and over him, twisting in mid-air so that when she landed, she was facing him. He tried to draw a knife from his belt, but she was faster, landing 3 consecutive blows to his head. He wobbled on his feet, and Gwen flicked him with a single finger. Like the others, he toppled from the wall. "You scare me sometimes," Gareth said. That's when he noticed an arrow protruding from a gap in the plate along her thigh. "What happened?" "I'm getting slow in my old age," she said. "Come on, I'll deal with it later." They raced along the wall toward the back of the castle, where it would be quieter. The peal of alarm bells from the temple faded away. 21. The Hinterlands. Lisbeth Lorne. The single word, spoken deep in the core of Lisbeth's soul, seemed to echo, "War, war, war, war." Though she was new to her body, new to this world and the actions of humans, Ghazi, animals, and all the other creatures inhabiting this continent, Lisbeth knew what war meant. Violence, destruction, death, spoils, victors, prisoners, pain, glory, fear. She didn't know how she knew. Only that the word made her want to race back out into the night, to run and run and run until her legs failed her, until her breaths came in rolling waves, until she was so utterly exhausted she couldn't think, couldn't feel, couldn't hear anything but the beat of her own heart as she drifted off into a peaceful sleep. A sleep without war. "I don't. I won't. I'm not here for that," she finally got out. The pulsing souls spread through the enormous tower built of snow and ice, the Hall of War, it is called, a fact she only now remembered, buzzed with confusion. And she finally understood what they were, souls, very much alive, trapped in sleeping bodies. Their sleep felt unnatural, just as the hollow voice ringing in her head felt unnatural. "Then why have you come to us? Why has the sky spit you forth and planted you here? If not to awaken us, to call us to war?" She found her words. "Coincidence. Misfortune. A random turn of events." She turned away, hearing their screams in her head, their anger at her abandonment, the pent-up violence twisting through their ancient souls. The moment she stepped back out into the frozen night, the voices fell away, stolen by a blast of icy wind. All was calm. All was quiet.
A figure stumbled through the snow, lurching toward her.
Xur crashed into her, his long, muscled arms slamming her to the hard-packed snow, his stringy hair bristling over her face. She felt like screaming, but could only gasp as the air left her lungs. She knew she could invade his mind again, could snuff out the last of his soul, that weak, barely there pulse, throbbing like a dying heartbeat.
I can't, I can't, I can't.
She stole my soul.
And then she was there, in that faded place that Lisbeth was beginning to realize was many years ago, before she had even contemplated the idea of being more than a ribbon of light, inhabiting a body in this world of sound and color and beauty and pain. This time, she didn't float above the memory like a gust of wind. Rather, she was the memory. She was the girl in the white dress, understanding her hopes, her dreams, her fears, her thoughts, her truths. The current carried the young girl into the water, tears streaming down her face. She didn't sink, but floated, her white dress heavy but not enough to drag her into the depths. No, it was her fear that was the true anchor, pulling, pulling. She whipped around, and her father was but a lone shadow in the distance, still retreating, unwilling to watch what was to come next. The other Ghazi remained, however, staring silently at her in the water. Her people. Familiar faces. Friends. Loved ones. She could swim back to shore, but what was the point? They would only force her back in, and her life was forfeit anyway. She'd carried the disease for 3 long years, and it would consume her any day. So she'd been chosen. A sacrifice to Sun Sun Matho, great hunter of the warm waters of Venus. She'd seen the lake monster before, once, during the last time of sacrifice. Then her father had been by her side, holding her steady, explaining what was happening. Not so she could learn, but so she could be prepared for when it was her turn. On that day, it had been an old man, Nero, the bulk of his life long past, his face calm and steady and free of tears.
Why me? She wondered now. Why me, a girl who has barely seen life, much less lived it?
She didn't have time to consider the mysteries of life and fate, however, because she felt it. It was surprisingly calm, gentle. The slightest displacement of water, a ripple uncoiling like a snake through the water, brushing against her. It almost tickled, the sensation like feathers on skin. That sensation turned the buzz of fear into a spike up her spine.
Why me? Why me? Why me?
Sun Sun Matho burst from the water, its sleek, scale-armored flesh beautiful in the light of the sun, changing color, red, green, yellow, blue. She saw its red eye, and in it was contained a depth she hadn't expected, an all-consuming understanding of the world around it. She could see the hunger in that look, but also the appreciation that she would come to it, a willing sacrifice. And though her fear refused to fade away, she thought, I can do this. She remembered that old man, who'd eventually panicked, attempting to swim for shore as the monster's fin closed in from behind. She remembered how she'd watched breathlessly as he'd been taken in a single gulp, his body vanishing in a splash so large it had created breaking waves on the shoreline. She didn't want to be that man, running from reality. I am going to die, she thought. Even if it wasn't today, it would be tomorrow, or the day after that. Not years, but weeks, months at best. This is what I can do to make my life meaningful. I can sacrifice for my people, for those loved ones watching. She looked back once more, just once, and found her father standing in the distance, watching, his hands covering his mouth. She did not scream, did not cry, did not panic. A warm calm set in, and she raised her hand high to her father.
Do not mourn me, the gesture said. Do not cry for me, for I am safe, father. Your little star is safe in the heavens.
She turned back, saw the humped, bone-hard skull of Sun Sun Matho as it closed in, slicing through the water like a knife through snow. She raised her hands above her head, whispering a prayer to Venus, to the god that gave her these years of life, and would now reclaim her. The monster opened its maw, its shining teeth like bone daggers set all in a row. It was darkness. It was light. It was truth. "Take me," she said. And then it did.
Why? Please.
Lisbeth knew she was begging those who couldn't hear her, who wouldn't hear her. For begging to change the past was as pointless as trying to turn stone into gold. Xur's soul was fading, sliding away like the girl, his daughter, had drifted into darkness, willingly and without regret.
"I took everything from this man," Lisbeth thought. "His memories, his dreams, his fears, his soul. I am evil. I am death. I am..."
An idea sprung forth, bursting through the contours of her mind like a green shoot through the dirt after a rainfall.
"I can give it all back."
Though she wasn't certain whether the thought was a foolish lie, the naivete of her newness to this world, she clung to the idea like a rope dangling from a cliff, thinking it over and over and over again until it wasn't a thought but a belief. She felt the third eye on her forehead burn, flashing in the dark, its blue light slamming into Xur's chest. He screamed, but she didn't stop, forcing her will upon him, expanding, shredding through flesh and muscle and bone, and then pouring into that last speck of soul that remained, a twinkling ember in the darkness, repairing, joining, healing. Images flashed. His daughter, laughing as he chased her around their dwelling, her face glowing with light from a fire as she told him a story while eating supper. The excitement in her eyes when she found a tiny pink flower growing against all odds in a snowdrift. Memories poured forth, 100, 1,000, a brief lifetime flashing in a moment. Xur groaned and rolled over, face first in the snow. Slowly, Lisbeth turned him over, watching his soul sleep for a moment. She slumped beside him, exhausted, staring up at the sky, at the billions of stars overhead. The red ones soared past, leaving behind fiery trails. The gold ones twinkled like flipped coins. The green ones exploded again and again. A vibrant, shifting soul blotted out the sky. Crone.
"So now, girl understands."
Lisbeth didn't have the energy to respond, so she merely nodded.
"Yes, I understand."
For she was not a destroyer of souls, but a strengthener, a forger, a bringer. And though the thought of war scared her, she knew it was her purpose.
22. The Northern Kingdom, Darin. Terin Shiri. The leftover soldiers of Darin were quickly learning that the armored knight was a man of his word. By the end of the third day, they collapsed in ragged piles, barely taking the time to stuff their mouths with sustenance before falling into their bunks. After day four, dozens left in droves, marching from the city in groups. Terin didn't try to stop them. He only wanted the strong ones anyway. He laughed at his own thoughts.
"None of them are warriors, save perhaps Sir Jonathan."
Just as quickly, he chided himself for being unfair.
"They are still here. They are still trying. And so are you. That has to count for something."
Terin only hoped that when the enemy finally arrived, those left wouldn't turn tail and run. Regardless, he knew he would stand and fight, even if it was only him and his monster to defend the city. He would defend Anise's kingdom to the bitter end, one way or another. And anyway, despite their faults, the men had talents of a different nature. Captain Morris, who was just Morris now that he'd been demoted, he'd almost looked relieved when Terin told him, had a remarkable ability to make self-deprecating jokes at the exact moment when the men seemed on the verge of giving up. They would laugh and continue on, having forgotten their struggles. It was a skill Terin had yet to master. The skinny old geezer, who everyone called Creak on account of the sound his knees made when he ambled past, could shoot an arrow as straight and true as any man Terin had ever met.
"I used to win every tourney I entered," the man said.
Terin had charged him with training the archers. They wouldn't get that much better in the short time they had, but any improvement was better than none. Fay, as she'd promised, had managed to find enough blacksmiths to keep the forges going day and night, the sounds of hammers meeting anvils providing a raucous accompaniment to every other activity. Terin stood watching Sir Jonathan drilling the men on the snowfields, which had begun to turn to slush under the strangely warm winter temperatures. Like Terin, ever since that night of unhappy stories, Sir Jonathan had thrown all his strength into the task at hand, training a bunch of green soldiers who'd spent more time drinking in the last year than fighting. But Sir Jonathan's story... Terin shook his head. It was worse than he'd ever expected. Cruel soldiers had broken into his home, had taken advantage of his wife, and had lied about it later when accused by the knight. Without proof other than her word against theirs, the charges had been dropped. His wife had descended into a dark place, and Sir Jonathan an even darker one, a place of shadows and sorrow and pain. And anger. Terin understood that part more than any of the others. Sir Jonathan had snapped. He'd cornered each of the three soldiers separately, disarming them and cutting off their manhood with their own blades. Then he'd killed them, slowly, painfully. He'd relished every cut, every scream of pain, every drop of blood that spilled out. When finally, his hands stained with the blood of a trio of evil men, he returned home, he found his wife dead, an empty vial with a distinctly bitter smell of darkweed lying beside her body on the floor. He'd carried her outside, his expression frozen, his mind blank, marching her through Darin in his arms, forcing everyone to see the unfair justice of the world they lived in. He knocked on the door of his commanding officer and told him everything, including his own crimes. He'd been in the dungeons ever since, having to daily make the decision not to kill himself. She wouldn't have wanted that. Until Fay had shown up and released him.
"Frozen hell," Terin thought. "What is wrong with this world and the people who live in it?"
Snapping him from his thoughts, a man approached, one of Fay's charges. Well, Terin was being generous, thinking of him as a man, for Lucky was half his size and a third his width, and looked as if a stiff breeze might knock him flat on his back. Still, Fay said the boy was a hard worker, and kept the fires burning hot. The boy was struggling under the weight of a large metal plate, which he carried with both arms. Somehow, he managed to reach Terin before dropping it awkwardly in the slush with a slight splash.
"Begging your apologies, Lord Commander," Lucky said. "Should have used a cart for that one."
The boy, like many of the others, refused to look directly upon Terin's face, except when they thought he wasn't aware of their stares. Terin frowned. He wasn't sure any of his men would be able to carry the plate of metal, much less use it for anything.
"What is it? Some kind of shield?"
Before Lucky could answer, Terin casually flipped it over with one arm as if it weighed nothing. The boy gawked at him. Terin ignored him, his breath hitching. For carved into the opposite side was the image of a large knight wielding a long length of chain attached to a spiked ball. What could only be Terin's weapon, designed by Fay herself, the Morning Star. Anger plumed from Terin's mouth as he grabbed up what he now realized was a chest plate, his chest plate. He shoved past Lucky, who yelped and dodged away, and marched for the forges, his own fires stoked by each step.
"Damn woman,"
he thought, kicking up slush as he stomped. He knew he should stop, should try to calm his temper before confronting Fay, but his feet just kept moving on their own. He burst into the sweltering area, the ching, ching, ching of hammers ringing in his ears, stalked to the back, where the largest fire of all was raging. That's where he found Fay, sheathed in sweat, her muscles taut and rippling, using a massive sledge to pound away at a piece of red-hot iron.
"What the frozen hell is this?"
Terin roared.
He felt the monster inside him stir, try to rise up, but he gritted his teeth and pushed it back down. Fay drove her hammer down twice more, sparks flying, before settling it gently on the bench, turning to face him.
"Your new chest plate," she said. "I thought that was obvious."
Terran felt his face flush, felt the monster probing at his weak spots. It wanted blood.
"No,"
he growled, low and dangerous. Fay's eyebrows narrowed.
"No, what?"
Terran shook his head, not wanting to explain.
"I explicitly ordered you not to work on my new plate until my men had been outfitted with weapons and armor."
"No,"
Fay said slowly, drawing out the word with a roundness that made it sound to Terran like she was speaking to a misguided child.
"You said not to have any of the men work on your armor until after the rest of the work was done. Thankfully, I am no man. We've got too many of them around here as it is."
Terran tried to rebuff her, but she went on.
"And you need armor as much as anyone. You're beginning to resemble a sardine in an old tin can. A very large sardine, yes, but not a look fit for the Lord Commander."
Terran growled again, but Fay refused to back down.
"I will continue with this project. If you don't like it, you'll have to restrain me."
He was aware that several of the other smiths had stopped what they were doing to watch the commotion.
"Fine,"
he grunted, hefting the plate with one arm over his shoulder and turning to leave.
"Did you even try it on?" Fay said to his back. "I need to know whether you need any alterations."
"I'll let you know."
Terran left, feeling frustrated.
"Is the North full of stubborn women?"
he wondered. "No," he thought.
"Just stubborn people in general."
It was their greatest strength and weakness. They didn't know when to give up. He stopped outside in the slush, trying to slow his breathing, trying to stop the thoughts of broken bodies, rivers of blood, severed...
"Ah!"
he roared, sprinting back toward the fields. He had to sate the monster's appetite, and there was only one way he knew how, other than violence, action, movement, work. He slung the chestplate to the ground and whipped out Morningstar, unleashing it into the clear sky, cutting silver arcs, sweat dripping from his face, his men, having long finished their own training, gawking at their Lord Commander with jaws open, mouths agape. He fought invisible enemies long into the night, until his soldiers left to take their evening meal, until he was alone.
"You are never alone,"
the monster reminded him, purring in the dark. Toward the south, well past the peaks of the mournful mountains, grey clouds of smoke blotted out the sky as the tangle continued to burn. The next day, Terran awoke to a headache, which was exacerbated by the clang of metal against metal. He groaned, squinting, when he opened his eyes to bright light hitting them.
"Top of the morning,"
a voice croaked, descending into a choking laugh cough. One eye opened just a slit. Terran gazed at Creek, who was sitting on the bottom bunk across from the aisle, staring at him.
"What time is it?" "Noonday, I'd say." "Why aren't you training the archers?" "The woman told me to watch you. Make sure you're okay." "What woman?"
Terran said, though he only needed one guess.
"The blacksmith. The one with the big mouth." "Do I give the orders, or does she?" "Most think it's near on the same thing."
Terran groaned again. It was hard enough organizing this strange assortment of castaways without Fay pulling stunts like this.
"May I speak freely?"
Creek asked.
"Don't you always?"
Creek chuckled.
"Good point. The blacksmith woman might be a stone-cold heartbreaker, but she's only worried about you. Truth be told, we all are. Since the day you showed up, you've hardly said more than a word to anyone. You stomp around like some beast from the hinterlands that looks like it wants to rip someone's head off. And then you go mad in an instant, working like a dog for an entire day without stopping. Leaves us all a little unsettled."
Terran jerked back.
Worried?
His men were worried about him.
Everyone watched you last night. I almost skipped dinner because of it, and that's saying a lot. We finally dispersed when we couldn't keep our eyes open any longer.
Terrin tried to remember last night, but it was all foggy, like it had been a dream. He remembered swinging Morningstar again and again and again. He remembered feeling the wind on his face, the slippery ground beneath him. He remembered the men watching him, but at some point they'd faded away, disappeared into the background, and all that existed was his weapon, his beating heart, and the thing purring inside him.
"Gather the men on the fields. I want to speak to them."
"Good idea," Creek said, his joints crackling as he rose and limped outside.
Terrin rubbed his face, trying to chase the sleep away. He hadn't slept that long in years. He started to stand, but cracked his head on the underside of the top bunk. He cringed, massaging his scalp. Lately, he'd begun to feel like a real-life giant. Fay was right. His armor was so tight against his skin it was bruising him. His entire body ached. After taking some time to clean his face in the washbin, he headed for the forge. When he arrived, it was deserted. Creek had followed his orders efficiently. He was about to turn away when he heard a noise in the back.
"Hello?"
he said. Fay eased around a wooden shelf full of raw materials, raising an eyebrow when she saw him.
"Welcome back to the Land of the Living. Want to tell me what that was all about last night?"
"No,"
Terrin said.
"I didn't think so. Let me know if you do."
"Look, Fay, I'm sorry."
She waved him away before he could finish.
"Nothing to be sorry about. You're damn right I circumvented your orders. But I'm not sorry about that either. You will have a fresh suit of armor. One that fits."
That's when he noticed the dark circles under her eyes.
"How late were you up?"
"As late as you," she said. "Wanted to make sure you found your way back into your bunk. Figured I might as well get some work done."
"Let me guess. You were up at the crack of dawn."
Something about one of his own working harder and longer than him didn't sit well with Terrin. He'd served under good leaders and bad leaders, mean sons of bitches and kind-hearted souls, but the ones he respected most were those who toiled alongside their men. That was the kind of leader Terrin wished to be, not a hot-tempered giant that everyone worried about. Fay smiled.
"I don't need much sleep. Heard you called a little meeting."
"Aye. The man you ordered to watch me sleep is organizing it."
Fay's smile broadened.
"I got these men wrapped around my small finger."
"Perhaps I could learn a thing or two from you,"
Terrin said. He turned away, then looked back.
"Coming?"
"Wouldn't miss it."
Most of the men were looking at his feet. The few brave souls who managed to meet his stare quickly looked away, flinching.
"Look at me," he said.
Some looked, some didn't. None held his gaze, except Fay, Creek, and Sir Jonathan, who seemed immune to his strange appearance.
"Look at me,"
he shouted. All eyes flicked to him, held barely.
"Don't look away,"
he ordered, tracking across each line of men, holding each set of eyes for a moment or two before moving on. He met all 126 pairs of eyes before he was finished. Fay's held sparkling amusement, Creek's curiosity. Morris's were bloodshot, likely from sneaking a bottle or 10 of ale. Sir Jonathan's were steel, as if forged by one of Fay's smiths. In between those familiar eyes were eyes of all shapes, colors, and temperaments. Individuals, each with their own hopes and dreams, fears and insecurities.
"I am just a man,"
Terrin finally said, when the silence had almost become another soldier standing amongst them.
"Just as each of you are."
Fay coughed. Terrin rephrased.
"A human like you. Something happened to me a long time ago, when I was a boy. It changed how I look. It changed something inside of me, too, but I hope it didn't change everything."
He paused, remembering why he wanted them all here in the first place.
"Why are you here?" he asked. "For the food," Creek shouted immediately.
The man had a quick tongue, Terrin had to admit.
Aye, Terran said. Castle food isn't half bad, but it won't last. So you have to find another reason, a bigger reason, or else you shouldn't be here.
Fay warned him away from the topic of leaving with her eyes, but Terran ignored her. No, he wouldn't hide from the steady flow of deserters. He would face them head on. It was the only way to stem the tide.
I will tell you my reason, Terran said.
The men shifted from foot to foot, like a habit, a way of keeping warm. They waited. Some had averted their eyes the moment they were no longer being ordered to stare at him, but most had not. Terran continued to meet their eyes, treating them like the individuals that they were.
I came here to protect someone, he said. That first day when I saw you lot, I almost left.
A few chuckles rolled across the crowd.
But someone convinced me to stay, and she was right.
Eyes shifted toward Fay, and Terran enjoyed watching her squirm in discomfort.
My reason for staying is my own, to protect Queen Anis Garrick, our lawful ruler, from the eastern invaders who would murder her and smash her throne. But that is only my reason. You each need your own. We don't have time to sit around and think about it. We have to keep training, but I want you to consider this question. If you don't have an answer by the time we see our enemy's weapons flashing over the cliffs, then you should leave. But even if you all leave, I shall stay. I shall fight. And I shall spill the blood of my foes across the land of our fathers and mothers, sisters and brothers.
Silence fell once more, the sun glittering through the clouds, which were thickening once more. Someone thumped their chest. Sir Jonathan, his expression coursing with determination.
I fight for my wife. May she rest in peace. That is my reason.
Several men nodded, gaining confidence from the knight, who Terran had appointed as their new captain. More fists thumped chests, and voices spoke over each other, stating their reasons for staying.
I got nothing better to do. I just like a good fight. I hate those damned Easterners. I always wanted to earn me knighthood. I really am here for the food, Creek's answer.
And many, many more, none better than another. As if in response, dark clouds assembled overhead, blotting out the sun. The temperature dropped, infusing the air with an icy chill. Snow began to fall in earnest once more, huge flakes that stuck to everything they touched, the men included. The soldiers thumped their chests and stomped their feet. Winter had returned, and with it their advantage. 23. The Hinterlands. Anis Garrick.
I should have stayed unconscious,
Archer said, rubbing his gloved hands together.
And I should have stayed in bed, Anis thought. Why had she ever wanted to flee into the hinterlands anyway?
They'd only travelled a day north of Castle Hill, and already the temperature had become colder than she'd ever experienced, which was saying something for someone who'd lived their entire life on this side of the Mournful Mountains. The storm had moved in so fast they'd barely had time to erect their shelters before it was upon them. With the howling wind and sleet, a fire was impossible. Cold, half-frozen water, hard bread and tough meat made for unsatisfying dinner fare. Anis longed for Terran, not for his humour or heart, but for his heat.
Frozen hell! I would love his warmth wrapped around me right now.
But longing and wishing was pointless. At least they were out of the wind, having dug a bunker deep into the snow to construct their thick tents. And they had plenty of warm woolen blankets, which they wrapped themselves in. In some ways it was humorous, the four of them in one medium-sized tent. Archer and Anis occupied one half, while Sir Dietrich and Sir Jonius crammed into the other. Before her father's death, she could never have envisioned such a scene. Anis giggled.
"Ha ha," Archer said. "I must have missed the part where any of this was funny."
She giggled again as the wind howled. Sir Jonius looked at her strangely. Sir Dietrich opened his mouth as if to speak, but then shut it, shaking his head. Perhaps he was remembering the beating she'd given him a day earlier. Anis said,
"I was just thinking,
How amusing it is that the four of us are here right now.
Archer made a face. Sir Jonius raised an eyebrow. Sir Dietrich said,
My queen is in a queer mood. We're searching for the sleeping knights. Doesn't that strike any of you as funny?
No one replied. Anise groaned. Terin would have gotten it. He understood her eccentricities like no one else ever had, including her Aunt Zelda.
Fine, she huffed. I shall wallow in self-pity like the rest of you. Good night.
She blew out the lantern, casting them all into complete darkness. Arch said,
If I was still king, I'd have sent you lot on this mission while I stayed warm in Castle Hill. I'll let you have a chance to be king, Anise said. Really? You have to fight me for it. No weapons.
Sir Jonius chuckled.
I'd like to see that.
Well, you're not going to, Archer said. She fights dirty. I won't stoop to that level. Now, if we joust it, forget it, Anise said. Horses are evil beasts, intent on tossing me in the snow.
Dietrich said, If I were king, I would declare winter a long holiday. No work, no war. Just warm fires and food.
If you were king, Anise said, hell would freeze over again.
Archer finally laughed. Dietrich did not.
Sir Jonius said, Sir Dietrich, I remember all too well being bested by you in the tourney. You are a fine swordsman, though I hear your hidden mark gains you quite an advantage.
Your point, sir. There was an edge to his voice. Anise knew from experience that the knight did not enjoy talking about his skin mark.
I do not intend to offend. I'm merely curious as to your background. Why did you avoid serving the Dread King for so long?
When Dietrich didn't answer right away, Sir Jonius added,
In truth, I wish I could have hidden myself as well. Unfortunately, I had no choice but to serve King Garrick.
Anise remembered the day she learned why Sir Jonius had been such an enigma to her for so long. How his wife had been sick for years. How only an elixir provided by her father's potion master, Darkspell, had kept her alive. In exchange for the potion, Sir Jonius had been forced to carry out all manner of atrocities in the king's name, a fact that continued to haunt him. Sir Dietrich sighed.
Why is everyone so nosy?
Though he sounded exasperated, Anise could tell it wasn't a refusal to answer the question. They waited. He said,
My father was a simple man, a stone worker in Gearhead. He'd been born there, and he always planned to die there. He didn't give much credence to the wars and territorial pissings of kings and queens. He lived for my mother, for me.
He paused, and Anise could hear him swallow in the dark. The patter of snow rustled against the tent. She wondered whether they'd need to awaken in the middle of the night to dig themselves out before it got too deep. She hoped not. Dietrich continued.
When the war front began to intensify at Raiders Pass, the Dread King himself rode through Gearhead, stopping briefly before marching to the border. Now his father, the undefeated king, had always been supportive of Gearhead's role in the war, providing brick and mortar, weapons, and provisions to his soldiers. Your father, however, wanted men. He recruited in Gearhead before continuing south. And by recruited, I mean forced every last man over the age of 12 to take up arms in defense of the kingdom. My father refused. Like I said, he was a simple man who didn't like to be bullied, not even by a king. Your father, as you might expect, didn't appreciate his ideals.
Frozen hell, Sir Jonius said. I remember him. I remember your father.
You should, Dietrich growled. You helped tie him up in the street, so his friends could see what happened to those who defied the king. I was only 8 years old.
Sir Jonius was silent for a moment, and then,
I'm sorry. I had no choice.
So you keep saying, Dietrich said. But there is always a choice. Your wife was dying, while my father was a strong, healthy man with many years left in his life. He was a good man, the best. Do you want to tell the Queen and Prince what their father did to my father? a rustle of blankets. Sejonius said,
"He killed him. Stabbed him through the heart. Left him to bleed in the streets. Everyone else joined the army, marching south with the king and I. We defeated the Easterners as they tried to battle through the pass. I was..."
His voice caught, trembled, and then found the words.
"I was thankful he hadn't made me kill him, your father. I was thankful that he had done it himself. I didn't think about who he was, or who he'd left behind, or whether he had a family, children. No. I never allowed myself to think about such things. I had to stay numb, or else I would never have been able to do the things I did."
Dietrich said, "After the army moved on, having cleaned out the city of able-bodied men, my mother and I cut the ropes from my father, cleaned the blood off his face and clothes, and buried him. We piled stones he had cut with his own two hands atop his grave. I cried for a long time. But eventually I stopped, and I vowed never to work for the dread king, even if it meant my own death. I never broke that promise."
"And then you met Taryn," Anise said,
the pieces to an old puzzle finally coming together. She was surprised at how easily his name slipped off her tongue, like it had been resting there the whole time.
"Aye," Dietrich said. "We faced each other at several tourneys. He even defeated my sword once, something no one had ever done. We became friends. He opened up to me about his past, and I reciprocated. He wasn't even bothered that I'd defeated him numerous times using my sword mark, and..."
"Wait," Anise said, her temper sparking.
"You're saying he knew about your mark?"
"Oops," Dietrich said, realizing his error. Anise gritted her teeth. All those times she'd complained about Sir Dietrich to Taryn, how he wouldn't tell her the truth. He'd known the whole time. And yet, she realized, he hadn't lied. He'd only advised her to give the knight time to explain himself.
"Because he was a true friend. Is a true friend."
No, she couldn't blame him for that.
"Go on," she said. "How did you end up in Castle Hill working for my mother?"
"The tourney was a good excuse to be there, but our true purpose was far more cunning. Queen Sabria had been searching for Taryn Sheary for some time, eventually realizing he was the same person as the Armored Knight, who had gained quite a lot of fame. Through Zelda, she brought him into her inner circle, and he vouched for me. We became her secret guard, you might say." A loop was finally closed, explaining so much about the last few months, how they'd gotten to this point.
"Thank you," Anise said, "for telling us, for helping my mother and Taryn. I'm sorry I've been so hard on you."
"So you'll stop throwing boots at me and rubbing snow in my face?" She could hear the smile in his tone. Archer said, "Boots? Sounds just like something my sister would do. I told you, she fights dirty." Ignoring the quip, Anise said,
"I can't make any promises, but I'll try. Now, get some rest. We move at first light, storm or not."
Surprisingly, the storm had moved on during the night, leaving behind an enormous white blanket in its wake. Jonius had gone out twice while they slept to shovel snow away from their tent, piling it in huge drifts that now resembled castle ramparts, a miniature version of Castle Hill. Twice he told them to sleep, that this act was part of his penance for crimes of the past. And he's tried arguing with him, to no avail. He was a man in a pit, and he would need to climb out of it on his own. There was no sign of dry wood, which meant no fire. They ate more cold meat and bread, and used their armpits to melt enough snow to drink. From there the going was slow through the snow, which reached Anise's waist, so they veered off toward the east, to where the frozen lake very much lived up to its name. Though it was also covered in snow, the drifts were mostly piled along the edges, the howling wind driving them into domed walls. On the frozen water, the snow reached only to their ankles, allowing them to travel much faster. The ice wouldn't break, not in winter. The only negative was the lack of protection from the wind, which seemed to have teeth, biting through cloth and armor. No one spoke, as their faces were covered by thick, triple-wrapped scarves. A day passed, then another. They camped right on the ice, without fire, without any heat other than that of their own bodies inside their tent. It wasn't enough. Anise could feel the ice settling into her bones, threatening to take her fingers, her toes. They would need fire soon, or they would all lose even more than that. Still, they pressed on, trying to cross